I saw Pharaoh carried from his tent in the centre of a knot of armed men. They hustled him up the slope of the hill to where his throne was set amongst the rocks, overlooking the plain and the wide sweep of the river. They lifted him to the throne and placed the crook and the flail in his hands and the tall double crown upon his head. Pharaoh sat like a marble statue with an ash-white face, while below him his regiments fell into their battle formations. Thanos had trained and exercised them well, and out of the confusion of the first alarm, order swiftly emerged. I ran down the hill to be near the king, and so rapid was the response of Lord Thanos' divisions that by the time I reached the foot of his throne, his army lay upon the plain like a coiled serpent to meet the menace of that boiling yellow dust cloud that swept down upon it. Kratos stood with his division on the right flank. I could recognize his tall figure on the first slope of the hill. His regimental officers were grouped around him, their plumes nodding and waving in the light morning breeze from the river. Thanos and his staff were directly below me, close enough for me to overhear their conversation. They discussed the advance of the enemy in cool academic tones, as though this were a sandbox problem at an officer's training course. Thanos had disposed his force in the classical formations. His heavy spearmen formed the front ranks. Their shields were interlocked and the spears' butts grounded. The bronze spearheads sparkled in the early sunlight, and the men's demeanour was calm and grave. Drawn up behind them were the archers. Their bows were strung and ready. Behind each man stood his quiver boy with bundles of spare arrows. During the battle, they would gather up the expended arrows of the enemy to replenish their own bundles. The swordsmen were in reserve, light and quick troops that could rush in to stop a breach or to exploit a weak point in the enemy formations. The moves of any battle were like those of the bear board. There were classic openings with set defences that had been developed over the centuries. I had studied these and written three of the definitive scrolls on military tactics that were the prescribed reading of officers' training in Thebes. Now, reviewing Thanos' dispositions, I could find no fault in them, and my confidence soared. How could an enemy prevail against this mighty host of trained and battle-hardened veterans, and their brilliant young general, who had never lost a battle? Then I looked once more beyond our ranks at that ominous rolling yellow cloud, and my confidence wavered. This was something beyond military tradition, beyond the experience of any general in all our long, proud history. Were these mortal men that we were facing, or, as rumour suggested it, were they fiends? When I stared into the swirling clouds, they were now so close that I could make out dark shapes in the dun and gloomy veils of dust. My skin crawled with a kind of religious horror as I recognized the ship-like shapes that our prisoners had warned us of. But these were smaller and swifter than any vessel that had ever been launched on water, swifter even than any creature that had ever moved upon the surface of the earth. It was difficult to follow one of these shapes with the eye, for they were ethereal and quick as moths in the light of a lantern. They wheeled and wove and disappeared in the moving clouds, so that when they reappeared it was impossible to tell whether it was the same or another like it. There was no way to count their numbers, or even to guess at what followed the first ranks of their advance. Behind them, the dust cloud extended back to the horizon from which they had come. Although our own ranks stood firm and steady in the sunlight, I could sense the wonder and trepidation that gripped them all. The studied conversation of Thanos' officers had dried up, and they stood in silent awe and watched the enemy deploy before us. Then I realized that the dust cloud was no longer advancing upon us. It hung in the sky and gradually began to settle and clear, so that I was able dimly to make out the stationary vehicles in the vanguard. But I was now so confused and alarmed that I could not tell whether there were 1,000 of them or more. We would learn later that this hiatus was always part of the Shepherd King's attack plan. I did not know it then, but during this lull, they were regrouping and watering and gathering themselves for the final advance. A terrible stillness had fallen on our ranks. It was so profound that the whisper of the breeze was loud through the rocks and the wadis of the hill on which we stood. The only movement was the flutter and swirl of our battle standards at the head of each division. I saw the blue crocodile banner waving in the centre of our line, and I took comfort from it. Slowly the dust clouds subsided, and row after row of the Hyksos craft were revealed to us. They were still too distant to make out details, but I saw that those in the rear were much larger than those leading their army. It seemed to me that they were roofed over with sails of cloth or leather. From these I saw that men were unloading what looked like large water jars and carrying them forward. I wondered what men could consume such large quantities of water. Everything these foreigners did was a puzzle and made no sense to me. The silence and the waiting drew out until every muscle and nerve in my body screamed out with the strain. Then suddenly there was movement again. From the front ranks of the Hyksos formation, some of these strange vehicles started towards us. A murmur went up from our ranks as we saw how fast they were moving. After that short period of rest, they seemed to have doubled their speed. The range closed, and another cry went up from our host, as we realized that these vehicles were each being drawn by a pair of extraordinary beasts. They stood as tall as the wild oryx, with the same stiff, upstanding mane along the crest of their arched necks. They were not horned like the oryx, but their heads were more gracefully formed. Their eyes were large and their nostrils flared. Their legs were long and hoofed. Striding out with a peculiar daintiness, they seemed merely to brush the surface of the desert. Even now, after all these years, I can recapture the thrill of gazing at a horse for the first time. In my mind, the beauty of the hunting cheetah paled beside these marvellous beasts. At the same time, we were all filled with fear of them, and I heard one of the officers near me cry out, "Surely these monsters are killers and eaters of human flesh. What abomination is this that is visited upon us?" A stirring of horror ran through our formations, as we expected these beasts to fall upon us and devour us like ravening lions. But the leading vehicle swung away and sped parallel to our front rank. It moved on spinning discs, and I stared at it in wonder. For the first few moments I was so stunned by what I was looking at that my mind refused to absorb it at all. If anything, my first sight of a chariot was almost as moving as the horses that drew it. There was a long yoke pole between the galloping pair, connected to what I later came to know as the axle. The high dashboard was gilded with gold leaf, and the side panels were cut low to allow the archer to shoot his arrows to either side. All this I took in at a glance, and then my whole attention focused on the spinning discs on which the chariot sailed so smoothly and swiftly over the rough ground. For 1,000 years we Egyptians had been the most cultured and civilized men on earth. In the sciences and in the religions, we had far outstripped all other nations. However, in all our learning and wisdom, we had conceived nothing like this. Our sledges churned the earth on wooden runners that dissipated the strength of the oxen that dragged them, or we hauled great blocks of stone over wooden rollers without taking the next logical step. I stared at the first wheel I had ever seen, and the simplicity and the beauty of it burst in upon me like lightning flaring in my head. I understood it instantly, and scorned myself for not having discovered it of my own accord. It was genius of the highest order, and now I realized that we stood to be destroyed by this wonderful invention in the same way as it must have annihilated the red usurper in the lower kingdom. The golden chariot sped across our front, just out of bowshot. As it drew opposite us, I dragged my gaze from those miraculously spinning wheels and the fierce and terrifying creatures that drew them, and I looked at the two men in the cockpit of the chariot. One was clearly the driver. He leaned out over the dashboard, and he seemed to control the galloping team by means of long plaited cords of leather attached to their heads. The taller man, who stood behind him, was a king. There was no doubting his imperial bearing. I saw instantly that he was an Asian, with amber skin and a hooked aquiline nose. His beard was black and thick, cut square across his breastplates, curled and intricately plaited with coloured ribbons. His body armour was a glittering skin of bronze fish scales, while his crown was tall and square. The gold was embossed with images of some strange god and set with precious stones. His weapons hung on the side panel of the chariot close to his hands. His broad-bladed sword, in its leather and gold scabbard, had a handle of ivory and silver. Beside it, two leather quivers bulged with arrows, and each shaft was fletched with bright feathers. Later, I would come to know how the Hyksos loved gaudy colours. The king's bow on its rack beside him was of an unusual shape that I had never seen before. It was not the simple, clean arc of our Egyptian bows. On the Hyksos bow, the upper and lower limbs recurved at the tips. As the chariot flew down our line, the king leaned out and planted a lance in the earth. It was tipped with a crimson pennant, and the men around me growled in perturbation. What is he doing? What purpose does the lance serve? Is it a religious symbol, or is it a challenge? I gaped at the fluttering pennant, but my wits were dulled by all that I had seen. It meant nothing to me. The chariot sped on, still just out of bowshot, and the crowned Asian planted another lance, then wheeled and came back. He had seen Pharaoh on his throne, and he halted below him. The horses were lathered with sweat. It foamed on their flanks like lace. Their eyes rolled ferociously and their nostrils flared, so that the pink mucus lining was exposed. They nodded their heads on long arched necks, and their manes flew like the tresses of a beautiful woman in the sunlight. The Hyksos greeted Pharaoh Mamosa, son of Ra, divine ruler of the two kingdoms, may he live forever, with contempt. It was a laconic and ironic wave of a mailed hand, and he laughed. The challenge was as clear as if it had been spoken in perfect Egyptian. His mocking laughter floated across to us, and the ranks of our army growled with anger, a sound like far-off thunder in the summer air. A small movement below me caught my attention, and I looked down just as Tanus took one step forward and flung up the great bow Lanata. He loosed an arrow, and it rose in a high, arcing trajectory against the milky blue sky. The Hyksos was out of range of any other bow, but not to Lanata. The arrow reached its zenith and then dropped like a stooping falcon full at the centre of the Asian king's chest. The watching multitude gasped with the length and power and aim of that shot. 300 paces it flew, and at the very last moment the Hyksos threw up his bronze shield, and the arrow buried its head in the centre of the target. It was done with such contemptuous ease that we were all amazed and confounded. Then the Hyksos seized his own strangely shaped bow from the rack beside him. With one movement, he knocked an arrow, and drew and let it fly. It rose higher than Tanus had reached, and it sailed over his head. Fluting like the wing of a goose, it dropped towards me. I could not move, and it might have impaled me without my attempting to avoid it, but it passed my head by an arm's length, and struck the base of Pharaoh's throne behind me. It quivered in the cedar strut like an insult, and the Hyksos king laughed again, and wheeled his chariot and sped away, back across the plain to rejoin his own host. I knew then that we were doomed. How could we stand against these speeding chariots, and the recurved bows that so easily outranged the finest archer in our ranks? I was not alone in my dreadful expectations. As the squadrons of chariots began their final fateful evolutions out on the plain and sped towards us in waves, a moan of despair went up from the army of Egypt. I understood then how the forces of the Red Pretender had been scattered without a struggle, and the usurper had died with his sword still in his scabbard. On the run, the flying chariots merged into columns four abreast and came directly at us. Only then did my mind clear, and I started down the slope at full pelt. Panting, I reached Tunnel's side and shouted at him, "The pennant lances mark the weak points in our line. Their main strike will come through us there and there." Somehow the Hyksos had known our battle order, and had recognized the lapse in our formation. Their king had planted his pennants exactly between our divisions. The idea of a spy or a traitor occurred to me even then, but in the urgency of the moment I thrust it aside, and it was for the moment forgotten. Tanus responded to my warning instantly, and shouted an order for our pickets to race forward and seize the pennants. I wanted him to move them so that we could deceive the enemy thrust on our strongest front. But there was no time for that. Before our pickets could reach and throw down the markers, the spearhead of flying chariots bore down upon them. Some of our men were shot down with arrows from the bouncing, swerving chariots. The aim of the enemy charioteers was uncanny. The survivors turned and raced back, trying to regain the illusory safety of our lines. The chariots overhauled them effortlessly. The drivers controlled the galloping, plunging teams of horses with a lover's touch. They did not run their victims down directly, but swerved to pass them at the length of less than a cubit. It was only then that I noticed the knives. They were curved outwards from the spinning hubs of the wheels, like the fangs of some monstrous crocodile.